This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Felix Contreras, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk and a writer for A Blog Supreme, NPR's jazz blog.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between. And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/Culturetopia. This week,
the ever-changing sound of Latin music in California, a look at the latest technological advances of 3D movies and the revival of those cool 3D glasses, and indie label Merge Records turns 20. But first,
zombies.
Zombies?
Zombies. These days it can be hard to find a place to hide from zombies, those undead, brain-eating monsters that seem to have overtaken nearly every form of media. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS has this report on the invasion.
Pop quiz hotshot. What would you do in a zombie outbreak? Don't panic. We have undead experts Kevin Workman and Kirsten Elms here to help. Question number one, how do you become a zombie?
If you're bitten, then in a certain amount of time, you will die and then you will come back from the dead.
Correct. Second question, how do you kill a zombie?
By removing the head or destroying the brain.
Very good. Plus, you get style points if you dispose of them with a chainsaw.
Groovy.
And what do zombies need to survive?
Brains.
Brains only.
Yes.
Brains good. But so are livers, hearts, and intestines.
Rule one for zombies, you have to want to kill people. You have to just want to rip someone's throat out. Doesn't matter if they're your mother or your kid. You just want to rip them to pieces.
George A. Romero defined the modern zombie in his 1968 film, Night of the Living Dead. Now zombies are mounting a full-scale invasion, shuffling aimlessly into every corner of our pop culture. At Borders, zombie literature runs the gamut from the Zombie Survival Guide to Pride and Prejudice in Zombies to Zombie Haiku.
My rigor mortis is mainly why I'm slower. And the severed foot.
Staring out from vacant eyes, these undead provide the perfect blank canvas for social commentary.
If you want to be able to tell somebody, hey, I don't like you and I don't like the way you're running the government, I don't like that your corporation's doing this. If I could tell it through a zombie movie, they're not going to care. They'd be like, oh, it's just a zombie movie.
Phil Luque points out that Romero uses them to comment on racism in Night of the Living Dead and then reanimated them in Land of the Dead.
Trouble?
In a world where the dead are returning to life, the word trouble loses much of its meaning.
These zombies raged against Dennis Hopper's George Bush-like leader. But zombies took on new meaning in Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead in 2004.
Our zombies are the metaphor for apathy. It's kind of like the great plague is laziness. So it's kind of almost like the zombies represent like sloth.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? If you get cornered, bash him in the head. That seems to work out. Keep together, stay sharp, and follow me.
Bashing zombies is a favorite pastime of video games, such as Resident Evil, Left 4 Dead, and Dead Rising, says Trent Reed.
Zombies aren't alive, so anything that you do to them doesn't really matter. You can kill them in the most ridiculous graphic ways.
And parents don't complain about the carnage, the way they did about killing hookers in Grand Theft Auto. Now, if those had been zombie hookers, it would have been a different story. And watch out for Nazi zombies rising from the grave in Dead Snow and Call of Duty World at War. But no matter what form these reanimated corpses take, just remember, aim for the head. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
We now turn to a film with a much more serious theme, a film called The Stoning of Soraya M. Sadly, it's based on a real incident that took place in 1986 in a remote village in Iran where a woman named Soraya was framed for adultery by her husband and then was punished and stoned to death. NPR's David Green spoke with the film's star, Shorey Agdashlu, and director Cyrus Noristey about the making of the movie.
Today I am old, 100 years older than yesterday. But I know right from wrong. What happened here yesterday was wrong.
I wanted people to never forget what a stoning really is. I tried to search out stonings in other movies, and they're all kind of like one rock gets thrown and the person keels over. Also, this movie, this is the climax of the movie, but what's wonderful about it is after the stoning, Zahra, the heroine of the movie, played so beautifully by Shoreh, turns this into a kind of triumph because she recognizes the importance of this story getting out and the world knowing what happened here so that this woman's death was not in vain.
And Shora Agdashu is with you and played the part of Zara, who is Soraya's aunt. Was that a difficult scene to be involved in?
Indeed it was, David. It took 6 days to shoot, and of course Cyrus covered it from all angles. I believe it was on the fourth or fifth day. I was sitting on the ground waiting for the next shot to come, and I opened my eyes for 1 second, and all I could see were dust, angry feet pounding the ground, angry fists in the air, and all I could hear was shouting, you know, Allahu Akbar, God is great. For 1 second, I really had a hard time to tell the difference between reality and cinema.
Who is Zara? Do we know what happened to the real Zara after the story came out?
We vaguely know that after Soraya died, Zara took care of the daughters of her daughters for a few years, and then she died of natural causes. That's all we know. She's a very powerful, strong woman, and the reason she's so powerful is because, according to herself, she was once somebody in this town. She was married to the mayor of the town, and most probably all these men who are running her around like a dog now were at her disposal once.
And you can hear the rest of the interview at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
We move from Iran to a different part of the world. Latin music is evolving as musicians move back and forth from various parts of Latin America to the U.S. They're mixing regional musical styles from all points south with American hip-hop and R&B. Corey Takahashi reports on the way multiple migrations are shaping music in California and beyond.
One of Eric Santero's earliest memories is roaming through Central America with his father, a singer from El Salvador.
I grew up with what we call the Sonidero sound system DJs, where it would be flatbed trucks that would roll into town with a bunch of homemade speakers and microphones and turntables, and they would just plug into a generator and they would play at the little festivals in these mountain villages that I was living in. But for me, that was like the moment of revelation where I was like, wow, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Santero's styles reflect the travel routes of his Salvadoran father and Guatemalan mother. They fled Central America during a time of civil war, natural disasters, and crumbling economies. His parents' goal was to get into the U.S. and stay there.
I was actually born in New York, but shortly after we were deported, so I grew up in Central America. It wasn't until many years later that we crossed the border back into the United States.
Santero absorbed more musical styles while living in New York, New Orleans, and his current home, Oakland, California. He's part of a loose-knit and far-flung group of artists he calls Latin Sound Systems, a kind of new generation of the roving sonideros he loved as a kid.
I don't really believe in borders, whether they be musical or geographic or nationalistic.
This track, Agua del Rio, features Santero along with rappers from Cuba and R&B singers from the San Francisco Bay Area. And there's the unmistakable guitar styling of bachata. Bachata began in the Dominican Republic, but Santero learned about the style from Dominicans in New York City. It's just one of the multiple migration streams that can be heard in music from the Latin sound systems.
You know, Linda, I produced that piece for the Arts Desk, and that's an excerpt that includes two more musicians, and all of the musicians are part of an evolution that's been going on for a while and incorporating the different styles and different types of music. And as an example of that evolution, this week marks the 10th anniversary of what's called the Latin Alternative Music Conference in New York. It's a gathering of musicians, promoters, radio people who are working or advancing or trying to do stuff with the style that's been called Latin Alternative. So if you look for it online and hear the whole piece, there's some really way cool music going on there.
I will look out for it. And you spoke about evolution. there is a little more going on about evolution over in the movies. Ice Age: Dawn of the Dinosaurs is the eighth movie that Hollywood has released this year in 3D. By the end of 2009, audiences will have donned their special plastic glasses for 13 films. That compares with just one 3D film in 2003 and none at all for a decade before that. Bob Mondello offers a three-dimensional review of Ice Age: Dawn of the Dinosaurs.
Dimension 1. Characters. Start with that single-minded saber-toothed squirrel, sniffing and snuffing in search of his beloved acorn. And he finds it, and something else. A lady squirrel, who is just as acorn-crazed as he is. You'll never find. Plus, woolly mammoths Manny and Ellie, who have a mini-mammoth on the way, and that means their little non-traditional family, Diego, a saber-toothed tiger who's learned not to eat his buddies, and Sid, a sloth whose mental ice tray is a couple of cubes short, are feeling left out. Which brings us to Dimension 2, plot. Sid falls through some ice into a warmer, center-of-the-earth-style world, finds three enormous eggs, and decides to use them to start a family of his own.
I'd like to present Egbert, Shelley, and Yoko.
Sid, whatever you're doing, it's a bad idea.
Shh! My kids will hear you.
They're not your kids, Sid. Take them back. You're not meant to be a parent.
Why not?
First sign, stealing someone else's eggs.
And therein lies the conflict, because after the eggs hatch, their biological parent shows up to claim them.
I thought those guys were extinct!
Well, then that is one angry fossil. Sid! Give them to her! She's their mother!
How do I know she's their mother?
What do you want, a birth certificate? She's a dinosaur!
Look, these are my kids! And you're gonna have to go through me to get them.
Fine with her, Mom disappears back down the hole with the hatchlings and Sid, and adventures ensue, including some with a new guy, a swashbuckling weasel, who I'm afraid I left out in Dimension 1 characters.
The name's Buck, short for Buckminster. What are you doing here?
Our friend was taken by a dinosaur.
Well, he's dead. Welcome to my world. Now, go home. Off you pop.
Maybe the deranged hermit has a point.
Manny, we came this far, we're gonna find him.
Which brings us to Dimension 3. How does the Ice Age message, basically everybody work past differences and get along, translate to 3D? Well, it certainly plays out with more visual depth, though the animators don't insist on shoving things into your lap every 3 seconds. Don't get me wrong, when pterodactyls fly over your shoulder, it's pretty persuasive, but the effect is becoming natural enough that I actually forgot for much of the picture that I was wearing glasses. Dimensions 1 and 2, characters and plot, are primary here, and if you can get over the not really minor quibble that elementary school teachers will now face classes absolutely convinced that the Ice Age marked the dawn of the dinosaurs rather than the death of the dinosaurs, it's a sweet little picture.
You know, I saw that movie, as it happens, with my nephews, who are 7 and 10. And I will say that my younger nephew spent quite a bit of the movie not wearing his 3D glasses. I think he's going to be a late adopter of the 3D glasses concept. And when most people think about seeing a 3D movie, the first thing that they think about are the old cardboard 3D glasses. But as NPR's Jesse Baker reports, the glasses themselves have evolved just as much as the movie technology itself.
When I say 3D glasses, don't think about those flimsy red and blue cutouts of the 1950s. Now, 3D glasses are polarized and built to eliminate eye strain and headaches. But they still take a little getting used to. Just ask Nazir and Selena Griffin here. They just saw Up in 3D.
How were the glasses?
Nice. But I don't really see stuff like popping out. I don't want to put them on.
How come?
Because I couldn't see with them.
Currently, there are two types of 3D glasses being handed out in theaters. Real D, the more popular option, are lightweight plastic glasses that you get to take with you when you leave. The Dolby 3D glasses have to be returned and washed in a giant dishwasher thing before they can be reused. The type of glasses you need depends on the type of screen your 3D film is projected on. How does 3D work? Amelia Bartolone will explain. She's an associate clinical professor at the SUNY College of Optometry in Manhattan, and she says 3D takes advantage of the fact that our brain doesn't want to see double.
So the image that is shown is the same image, just displaced a little bit. And the glasses are a way of filtering it out so that the right eye sees one image and the left eye sees another. And in order for the brain not to see double, it has to aim and focus in front of either the movie screen or the 3D test that you're doing. And that's how the object pops out.
That's the technology. But the movie still needs a compelling plot.
When you make a movie solely for the purpose of making a 3D movie, I can almost guarantee you it's not going to work.
Greg Foster of IMAX Filmed Entertainment says the story needs to transport you somewhere.
That can be the top of the International Space Station, under the sea. That can be Hogwarts. That can be the North Pole on the Polar Express.
Got your 3D glasses? Okay, you're going up.
In this New York theater, an adult 3D matinee is $16.50. Okay, kids, don't worry. I have an argument to get your parents to shell out those extra bucks. Eye doctors say this 3D craze could actually do some good for your eyes. Optometrists use 3D effects to help children with lazy eyes learn how to aim and focus. So watching a 3D movie is kind of like spending an hour and a half doing eye exercises. Clayton Bush, Ariel Cundy, and Shani Guthrie just finished their eye exercises.
It was a little bit hard to focus.
3D sometimes makes my eyes go, like,
it's
dizzy.
Hard to focus,
yeah,
for a while.
Because when things move really
things
fast.
Move. Taking 3D glasses off was tough, though, because everything else was blurry. But
so, judging by at least these three New York moviegoers, we might just be a nation in need of a national eye exam. For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker in New York.
Okay, Linda, listen to this. That's the sound of Merge Records, a small independent label based in North Carolina, and it's celebrating its 20th anniversary. At a time when the record industry as a whole is struggling, Merge is celebrating. What started as a tiny outlet for local bands has grown into one of the most respected and successful independent labels in the music business. Its roster includes M Ward, Arcade Fire, and Spoon, and the label's releases have even begun to crack Billboard's top 10. Jacob Gans tells us about the label's simple formula for success.
This is the sound of The Garage, North Carolina, 1989. The band is Superchunk. In the spring of 89, two of its members, Mac McConn and Laura Balance, were looking for a way to release 7-inch singles of their band and other local groups.
We figured, you know, why not put these singles out so at least there's some record of these bands that we really like.
And some chance that someone outside of Raleigh and Chapel Hill would get to hear them and something they could take on tour with them.
So they launched Merge. Today, starting a small label can be as simple as firing up the laptop, pressing record, burning CDs, and then posting samples on MySpace. But 20 years ago, the process was a little more mysterious.
For me, growing up and looking at my dad's record collection, I didn't know how stuff got from being music that was played by the Rolling Stones somewhere to being on a record, you know what I mean, to being in my dad's living room.
Getting music into living rooms can still be kind of complicated, especially when you're dealing with physical CDs. Once you've actually made them, you still have to get them into stores, mostly small independent ones. Then comes publicity and radio play and touring to let fans know the records are out there. What continues to set Merge apart from other labels doing this is that it hasn't built its rep on a single band or sound. Alex Ross writes about classical music for The New Yorker magazine.
It's kind of like a cross-section of the entirety of pop music, or it is indie music, of the last 20 years.
The names include Lamb Chop.
To whom can I speak today? The brothers, they are evil. And the old friends of today, they have become unlovable.
Magnetic Fields.
I don't want to get old.
Neutral Milk Hotel.
When you were young, you were the king of Cali.
Arcade Fire. Even if the music doesn't all sound alike, there is a unifying sensibility, says Rich McLaughlin. McLaughlin runs The Alternate Side, an indie music show on WFUV-FM, and programs one of the station's HD channels. He says FUV gets over 100 CDs a day, all vying for attention.
There are very few labels, I think, that you can trust their entire roster of artists. So I think when you see Merge Records envelope coming in, it's something that you set aside because you have a pretty good idea that you can trust the label and trust their output.
Every one of those Merge bands is handpicked by Laura Balance and Mac McCon, who still run the label out of North Carolina without any investment from a major. They say that the exposure that comes with a release by Arcade Fire brings new listeners within their reach. But working on a small scale doesn't mean that each new record isn't a gamble.
Oh, they're all gambles. Every single one.
It's just that we're gambling with very small amounts of money.
Yeah.
Even so, McCon and Balance have to be tough.
It doesn't always make bands happy to be told, we're expecting your record will sell maybe 2,000, and that's how we're going to market it. But I guess, you know, running a successful business sometimes involves saying things that aren't always nice for people's feelings.
They're not going to spend tons of money on the things that aren't really necessary. They're very frugal.
Britt Daniel is the singer for the band Spoon, which signed with Merge in 2001 and has stayed with the label ever since. Spoon is now one of Merge's biggest successes, but at the time the musicians were signed, they looked like damaged goods. They had just been dumped by Elektra Records and were anything but a sure bet.
There was a small amount of investment on their part, and it wasn't necessary that we sold, you know, 100,000 records in order for them to turn a profit. So I guess sort of long term, it was just about the ability to just put out records at our own pace, the kind of records that we wanted to make, and do exactly what we wanted to do.
Anything you want. Come on back, 'cause it's all still here.
A big part of the label's anniversary celebration this year is a 14-CD, mail-order-only box set. Mac McCon admits it's ridiculous, but insists that it's exactly the kind of package, extravagant, mysterious, and lovingly curated, that he dreamed about when he and Laura Balance started Merge 20 years ago.
I think that we've always run the label as music fans, you know? And I think that our customer base is music fans. We start a label and we run a label counting on there being people like us.
For two decades, at least, they've been right. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
Heard a lot of good music today.
That's jam-packed with good music.
Absolutely. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already at npr.org/culturetopia.
I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And thanks for listening to Culturetopia.
Don't say a word. The last one still stinging.